VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
According to independent analysis by NASA and the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Earth's global surface temperature in 2018 was the fourth warmest since 1880. NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies says 18 of the 19 warmest years during that time all have occurred since 2001. The central aim of the Paris Agreement within the United Nations framework on climate change is to bolster the world's response to the threat of climate change by keeping a global temperature rise this century well below 2 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. The pact also encourages efforts to limit the temperature increase even further to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. So why is keeping the global temperature rise to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius so important? According to the Climate Reality Project, a nonprofit organization focused on climate change, 1.5 degrees is right about the point that scientists project we'll see some of the climate impacts we already see today begin to go from bad to outright terrifying. The organization also says it's about the point where we'll likely see many natural systems begin to cross dangerous points of no return, triggering lasting changes and transforming life as we know it. Scientists have determined that Earth is already 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial levels of the early to mid-1800s. While these numbers and statistics related to global warming and climate change may not mean much to most of us, a new best-selling book by David Wallace Wells writes about how an increasingly warming planet will come to affect humanity unless dramatic measures are taken very soon. The book is called The Uninhabitable Earth: Life After Warming. David Wallace Wells joins us today via Skype to talk about his book and as well as what life on Earth would be like should we reach that point of no return. David, the opening line to your book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, is, "It's worse, much worse than you think." What did you mean by this, and did you purposely use it to set the tone of what was to come in your book?
Yeah, absolutely. What I meant was sort of threefold, which is to say that I felt, coming to the subject myself, that there were three big misunderstandings that I had about climate change that I had been given by the way that we talked about climate, that we, our journalists reported it, our advocates and policymakers talked about it. And I wanted to sort of correct those three misunderstandings. So they were, to take them in order. The first was about the speed of change. You know, I had been raised, I would say, to believe that climate change was really slow, that it was something that would be unfolding over decades, if not centuries. We often talked about it as a legacy of the Industrial Revolution. And James Hansen, who's a quite alarmist, outspoken climate scientist, the name of his book for a general audience is Storms of My Grandchildren, which gives you a sense of, you know, this is quite far away. And as a result, I think you could naturally assume that we had a lot of time to grow our way out of it, to innovate our way out of it. But in fact, half of all of the emissions that we've put into the atmosphere in the entire history of humanity from the burning of fossil fuels have come in just the last 30 years, which means we're doing this damage really dramatically in real time. That's 30 years is since Al Gore published his first book on warming. It's since the UN established its IPCC climate change panel. And I'm 36 years old, so it's, my life contains that story as well. When I was born, the planet was in a quite stable situation. Scientists were a little bit worried about the medium-term and long-term future for climate change, but in the near term, everything was okay. And now we're on the brink of catastrophe, and that is because of what we've done just in the last 30 years. There was a report that came out today that we've, you know, not only have we reached a record high for carbon concentration in the atmosphere, but that in the last year, 2018, we actually grew our carbon concentration at the fastest rate on record, which means that we're doing this damage more quickly every year. This isn't just a matter of our not moving fast enough to reverse the trend of carbon emissions. We're doing more damage every year than the year before. So we're really doing this damage quite quickly. And the story of climate change as a whole is a real-time, rapid story. That was the first big misunderstanding. The second one was about scope. So I heard a lot about Arctic melt and sea level rise. And I think most people who did could feel that if they'd lived anywhere but the coast, that they were relatively safe. And even if they lived on the coast, they could probably move away from it and still be okay. But the more that I started to learn about the economic impacts, which threaten a global GDP that could be 30% smaller than it would be without climate change by the year 2100, if we don't change course, that's an impact that's twice as deep as the Great Depression, and it would be permanent. The more I learned about the effect on agricultural yields, which could be half as bountiful as they are today, and we'd be using those yields to feed maybe 50% more people, the more I learned about the effect of on violence, where we could have twice as much war as we have today if we don't change course, because there's a relationship between temperature and conflict, the impact on public health, where already 9 million people are dying every year from air pollution that's related to the burning of fossil fuels, not to mention the extreme weather, the hurricanes, the 500-year storms hitting every year, the wildfires burning through huge portions of California every year. The more I started to see that this was a totally all-encompassing story, not something that you could compartmentalize or localize and get away from. And so I think we had a kind of basic misunderstanding about the scope of the story, which enclosed all of us, no matter where we were. And then the third big misunderstanding was about severity. You know, I read a lot about this level of warming 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average, which scientists talked about as a level of catastrophic warming in the island nations of the world called genocide. And scientists would often say we need to do everything we can to avoid this level of warming. I think most people who were kind of casually following the story interpreted that to mean that this was basically a worst case scenario. But in fact, given where we are now, which is about 1.1 degrees of warming, which, by the way, is already warmer than it has ever been in the entire history of humanity, 2 degrees is basically our best case scenario going forward, and the levels of warming above that, say 3 degrees or 4 degrees, where we are on track for by the end of the century, nobody had really reckoned with what that would mean, not just in terms of what it would promise for grain yields and warfare and conflict and all that kind of stuff, but also what it would mean to our politics and our geopolitics, our culture, our storytelling, our technology, our relationship to capitalism, our relationship to history and to progress, our sense of our place in nature. And so in the book, I tried to give a sense of that grand scale of the story that is enclosing all of us and dictating really in some profound ways how we'll live in the future, but also transforming so many of the things that we sort of take for granted as permanent features of modern life, such that, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now, I think we'll be living in a world that is really written with a signature of climate change, that bears the fingerprint of climate change, no matter where we are and no matter what kind of life we're living. And, you know, altogether, that to me seemed to suggest the saga as a whole was just a much bigger, much more all-encompassing, much more dramatic story than even those people who were writing about it, talking about it every day in the newspapers and in their advocacy work had really communicated to the public. So I hoped that my book would sort of be a bit of a corrective to that story. And I think judging from the reaction in the public, I think it has to an extent.
Would you say that your book more or less is addressing this issue, not from a scientific aspect, but from a more human aspect, a more personal aspect?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not even really a science journalist. You know, I have an interest in the near future. And so I've always been interested in the news from science, but it's not really where I live emotionally, psychologically, where I work every day. And I'm a lifelong New Yorker, which means I like going on a vacation into a place I think of as nature, but I actually don't think of myself as being someone who's especially connected to it. I've never had a pet. I don't have that kind of deep love for animals. And so in all these ways, I'm a kind of unusual, unlikely environmentalist, but that also, I think, is just a sign of how dramatic these impacts are, that even someone like me, who has no reflexive love for the natural world per se, still is brought to the point of constant panic attack by learning about what is in store for us in the future, because what's in store for humans is quite dramatic enough. And that's another way that I think much of the storytelling about climate had sort of let us down over the last few decades, is that we heard a lot about the plight of the polar bears, but the truth is that the impacts on humans are just as dramatic, maybe more dramatic. And what I mean when I say that, I don't think the human animal is going to go extinct. I don't think that our civilization is going to collapse because of climate change. But when you understand that we are now living outside the window of temperatures that enclose all of human history, what that means is that everything that we've come to depend on in modern life, but even beyond that, all the way back through agriculture and the evolution of the human species to begin with, all of that was dependent on climate conditions that no longer prevail. So it's almost as though we've landed on a new planet and are trying to figure out what of the culture that we've brought with us will endure under these new conditions, which, by the way, are going to keep changing actually probably more quickly in the next couple of decades than they've changed in the last couple of decades. And I don't know what that means for how civilization will endure, but I think it will endure. The question is in what form, transformed in what ways, and leaving what kinds of imprints on us. And I think that's really, for my money, the focus of the book, even more than the sort of direct climate questions beyond the science, are these kind of humanitarian questions, these humanities questions of what it will mean for our psychology and our politics and our literature and all the rest of it to be living in a world that's degraded in these ways and is continuing to be degraded, at least for a time, probably by our own hands.
David, I'm curious. We've known about climate change. Climate change has been in the news for at least 2 decades, you know, that I can recall, perhaps even earlier than that. Being that there has been so much about climate change in the news and the dangers of climate change, as you had mentioned, why has the level of carbon output increased and the problem from climate change been escalating just in recent years?
The short answer is because we haven't responded to the news from science by doing anything about it. And I think that it's a complicated riddle to solve. I think part of the reason is that we all have psychological biases and prejudices and emotional reflexes that make us reluctant to take seriously really scary scenarios. And we also have what a behavioral psychologist calls status quo bias, which is that we prefer not to change things rather than change things, even if we know that they're necessary. And that those sort of biases are a problem for us, not just at the level of individuals, but at the level of policy and politics and at the level of our geopolitics, where we have a kind of collective action problem, which is to say that even if all the rulers of the world agree that climate change is a problem, and we really needed to decarbonize quickly, that each one of those nations would have an incentive to sort of slow walk and let the rest of the world clean up the mess.
You brought this up earlier, David, and I guess the word is apathy. For a long time, people have seen climate change as something that will take place very slowly, and it's going to happen in the distant future. So if that's not the case, what is the current timeline and the pace of climate change at this point?
Well, really, it's a huge open question based on what we do. So scientists will talk about these things called uncertainty bars around all of our projections, which is to say we don't really truly understand where we'll be at, say, precisely 2064 or 2082. And there are some elements of the science that are uncertain in that way. But much more important is the open question of what we will do, because the main driver of climate change for now and for the very foreseeable future is how much carbon we put into the atmosphere. So on some level, that should be comforting, empowering, because it tells us that we are in control of the system. And, you know, sometimes I hear from deniers and climate skeptics who say, oh, what we're just seeing are natural cycles. This isn't anthropogenic. It's not human caused. Mm-hmm. And to them, I say, well, if that were the case, I would be truly terrified, because it would mean we would have no lever to pull to change it. And if we're still heading on the same track that we're heading on now, which is to say we're following the trajectory that in previous eras of planetary history led to mass extinctions where 95 or 97% of all life on Earth died, and we had no control over it, that would be absolutely awful. On some level, it's comforting and even empowering that we are doing this damage. On the other hand, we are doing this damage, and we're doing that damage knowingly, understanding at some level exactly how much we're damaging the future of the planet. And I think, you know, that's terrifying in its own right. So up until recently, I would say that, you know, the kind of like biases that I mentioned earlier were one problem. I also think that the sense that we had that this was a long-term problem was also a reason we didn't take sufficient action. But a third, I think probably critically important part of that explanation is that until very recently, the economists of the world believed that fast action on climate would be very expensive, because it would mean massive upfront investment in infrastructure projects and the like, and R&D in renewable energy. And it would also mean foregoing some amount of economic activity in the case of, say, retiring a coal plant that was not yet ready to be retired. I think for a long time in the West, at least, our policymakers have really been focused on the North Star of economic growth. And so if they heard from their economic advisors that action on climate would be damaging to that growth, they were really unwilling or unlikely to do it. But that conventional wisdom has actually been totally reversed just over the last few years, such that every economist you talk to now is quite clear when they say that, you know, faster action will be better for us, even in the quite short term. There was a report in 2018 suggesting we could add $26 trillion to the global economy through rapid decarbonization. And the government of Indonesia, which is a kind of a case study in the developing world, a representative story, because over the last two decades, they've halved their poverty rate, they've doubled their per capita income, but they've done that by industrializing, which means that they've also doubled their emissions. But they say now that they could halve their emissions by 2030, which would put them ahead of the commitments that they made under the Paris Accords. And that's notable because at the moment, no nation in the world is on track to meet those accords. They could meet those accords and even improve upon those commitments and still grow at 6% per year, which is faster than the 5% per year that they've been growing over the last two decades when they doubled their per capita income. So I think that shows you just how different the calculus is, even in the developing world, where for a very long time, it was understood that you'd have to sort of choose between economic growth that pulled people out of poverty and responsible behavior when it came to climate. Now it seems we're starting to understand that we don't have to choose between them. We can grow quite quickly and still grow responsibly so long as we make the right decisions. Now the question is, how quickly will that conventional wisdom circulate and transform the thinking of policymakers around the world? Because it can't just be the government of Indonesia who's making those changes. It has to be all of us. That's the nature of the problem. It's all encompassing.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I am Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, or from iTunes. We hope you'll get in touch with us either through Facebook or Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or by sending us an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Now, back to the science edition of Press Conference USA. Today we're talking with author David Wallace Wells about his best-selling book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. David, you say in your book that by the end of the 21st century, parts of the Earth could be nearly uninhabitable while other parts inhospitable. Could you please explain this?
Well, you know, in small parts of the planet, those effects are already the case. There are parts of sub-Saharan Africa that are dealing with really catastrophic droughts and famines. And, you know, you wouldn't say that they're exactly uninhabitable yet, but they are quite difficult to live in at the moment. But the impacts are going to accumulate quite quickly. Those studying the effect of direct heat, which is a sort of underappreciated impact of climate change, say that many of the biggest cities in South Asia and the Middle East will be unlivably hot as soon as 2050, which means that in summer, you won't be able to walk outside in those cities without risking heat stroke and possibly death. And these are cities that some of them have 10, 12, 15 million people living in them, which is one reason why the UN thinks that just by 2050, which is, you know, it sounds a little bit far away, but it's just the
length of a mortgage.
It's really not. We could have as many as 200 million climate refugees, and they think it's possible we could have as many as a billion, which is as many people as live today in North and South America combined. Now, I think those estimates are a bit high, but even if you take the low number, 200 million, and divide it in half, it's still 100 times the size of the Syrian refugee crisis that has completely transformed European politics. And I think that's something that people who are sort of more casually engaged in the subject don't entirely appreciate. It's not just a matter of discrete impact, say a wildfire here, a drought there. It's that these things really cascade onto one another such that a drought produces a famine, produces social instability, produces political instability, produces a civil war. And that state then is unable to deal with future impacts, another weather event that might come. And that's what we're dealing with across the globe. At the moment, you know, there aren't many parts of the planet that are being impacted by so many different climate impacts at once. But there's really good research suggesting that by the end of the century, 2100, there will be parts of the planet that could be hit by 6 climate-driven natural disasters at once. And I don't think there's really any government on the planet at the moment that seems capable of dealing with those kinds of shocks on any kind of regular basis. And I say that, that's 2100. But just to put it in the present tense a little more concretely, you know, we hear a lot when we talk about extreme weather about this figure, 500-year storm. It's a quite useful baseline for understanding how intense a storm is. It means a storm that's supposed to come only once every 500 years. And that means once during the entire history of Europeans living in America. 500 years ago was when Europeans first settled here, which means we're talking about a storm that's supposed to hit only once during the entire colonial period, the entire, you know, extermination of the native population, the American Revolution, the building of a slave empire, the Civil War, industrialization, World War I, World War II, the Cold War, the end of history, September 11th, the financial crisis. We're talking about a weather event that was supposed to happen only once during all that time. And just in the last 3 years, just in Houston, they've had 3 500-year storms. And that tells you just how unprecedented the weather system that we're living in already today is. And it's going to get, we know from the science, it's going to get dramatically worse in the decades ahead.
What I notice, David, that there are aspects of climate change, global warming, that seem to play into each other. For example, you're talking about ice melt in the Arctic and Antarctic. And of course, ice melt leads to sea level change and sea level rise. So there'll be less land for people to inhabit. And then on top of that, you have, as you mentioned, the 500 or 1,000 year storms. You have extreme climate going on. You have devastating hurricanes, floods, and they all seem to play into each other. Wildfires, again, another example in California, seemed to be ongoing. So, in other words, it seems as though it's going to be difficult to grab one aspect of a solution to try to solve all these problems.
Well, that's why I think, you know, the best solution is really reducing our carbon as dramatically, as rapidly as we can, because that's the main driver of all of them. If what we're trying to do is just deal with those problems, just adapt to this new normal, which is an ever-evolving normal, ever-worsening normal, I think, yeah, you're exactly right. It's going to be very, very hard. And I recently wrote a story in New York Magazine about the California wildfires in particular. I talked to Eric Garcetti, who's the mayor of LA, and has this really, his life story tells this story very precisely. He's 48 years old, not an old guy. The year he was born, 60,000 acres of forest burned in California. The year he was elected mayor in 2013, it was 600,000 acres. The year he was reelected mayor in 2017, it was 1.2 million acres. And last year, 2018, it was 1.9 million acres. And he told me very straightforwardly, point blank, there's no amount of firefighters we could hire, no amount of fire engines we could buy, no amount of brush we could clear that will stop this. He said, the only thing that will stop this is when the climate system of the planet, he said, probably long after we're gone, relaxes into a more predictable weather state. And I think that that gets exactly to your point, which is to say, if we're going about this trying to deal with one impact by impact, we're going to be overwhelmed by how much worse each impact is getting because of how rapidly the climate is changing. If we have any hope of living in a kind of stable, happily habitable planet, we need to dramatically reduce the amount of carbon we're producing so that all of these impacts are much less intense when they do hit. So we have only Category 5 hurricanes rather than Category 6 and Category 7 hurricanes, so that we only have 1.9 million acres in California burning every year rather than 10 million acres by 2050, which is what the science projects if we don't change course. There's decent science suggesting that we could have 75% of the entire state of California would be burning every year by the end of the century if we don't change course. Now, I think that's a little bit of a kind of an ignorant estimate, but it also reflects just how bad these trajectories are if we continue on the path that we're on. Our only hope is to change course and change those trajectories, which will affect every impact from drought and famine to wildfire and all the rest of it.
David, some climate scientists have said that Earth is close to or has gone beyond the tipping point where the effects of climate change are irreversible. Do you see this, and will this happen, or has this happened?
Personally, that's not how I see it, but I don't want to present myself as a more informed expert than scientists, but I would say that the majority of climate scientists don't see that as being the situation today. They're worried that there are tipping points. Some of them say they'll be between 2 and 3 degrees Celsius of warming. Some say between 3 and 4, others at further points down the line where what are called feedback loops could kick in. And these are natural systems that could accelerate the pace of warming. So to take one example, the ice in the Arctic and Antarctic, it's important as a store of water, and it's why the sea levels are where they are today. But it's also white, which means it reflects a lot of sunlight back into outer space. If all of that ice melts, it will be replaced by dark water. Mm-hmm. And dark water absorbs much more heat than white ice. This is the reason why, you know, if you wear a black shirt during the summer, you're hotter than if you wear a white shirt. So if we lose all of that Arctic and Antarctic ice, then the planet will be absorbing more sunlight all the time, which would make it considerably hotter than it would be if it was reflecting some of that. That's one of these so-called feedback loops. There are a number of others. Probably some are already being triggered at the moment, but the most dramatic ones we think are still a ways away. But it's just another reason why we need to more rapidly decarbonize so that we can try to avoid triggering these feedback loops, which could push us, you know, much, much further into the danger zone than we are today. There was a really terrifying paper I read a few months ago suggesting that I think it was about 1,300 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere, which is well more than we have today, but which we could conceivably reach by sort of the early middle next century. The planet could entirely lose its ability to form clouds. And that impact alone could add 8 degrees Celsius of warming to our climate change, which would mean we'd probably be at about 5 degrees of warming already. That would mean, you know, $600 trillion in global climate damages, which is double all the wealth that exists in the world today. It would mean twice as much war or more, all the other impacts I mentioned. And yet all of a sudden, rapidly, the loss of cloud formation, the loss of capacity to form new clouds would bring us from that level 5 degrees to 13 degrees of warming, which would practically speaking make huge parts of the planet, maybe all the way up through the northern latitudes and into the Arctic and Antarctic circles, unlivable for humans as we live today.
With the growing crisis, as you describe it in your book, David, there seems to be a growing doubt regarding climate science and even science in general, especially here in the U.S. A number of what some call climate skeptics have been getting a lot of attention in recent times. How do you respond to those who may insist that if there is climate change, it's not necessarily caused by humans, and that it's a normal, natural phenomenon, that the Earth has experienced this many times in the past?
Well, I would say it's actually quite an easy argument to refute, in the sense that even if you just took the very basic understanding of the greenhouse effect that was first identified in the middle of the 19th century by John Tyndall and Eunice Foote, and input into that equation the amount of added carbon that we've added to the atmosphere, you would get a prediction very, very close to exactly the amount of temperature rise that we have today. So there's no need to look for additional explanations or, you know, additional causes. We have a very, very neat prediction that could have been falsified by our experience and, in fact, has been confirmed by our experience. I think we know everything we know about the way that these gases work, tell us that the Earth will respond this way, and it has. I think that on the question of climate skepticism, climate denial more generally, you know, I think that it's true that our politics is captive to some of these interests. But when I look at the polls, I see actually a very different story. You know, 73% of Americans believe climate change is real and happening now. 70% of Americans are concerned about it. Those numbers are up 15 points since 2015. They're up 8 points since last year. That's really dramatic movement by any political science standard. And it's especially dramatic considering that we live in such partisan, tribalized times that very few people have ideas about anything going on in the world that isn't processed through a partisan lens. And if we have 73% of Americans who believe that climate change is real, when one of our two major parties is really committed to a program of at least skepticism, if not outright denial, that's really a remarkable figure. It also tells you that 27% of Americans don't believe in climate change, and that number is considerably higher than I would want, but it's about the same number as the number of Americans who believe that aliens live among us. 26% of Americans believe that aliens live among us. And we don't give veto power over our climate policy or our NASA policy to those people who believe aliens live on Earth. We shouldn't be giving a veto power to those people who believe that climate change isn't real. It's the same number of people. Probably in a lot of cases, it's the same people. And when I see much more robust support for belief in climate change and action on climate change, then I think our discourse necessarily reflects. I think because we are used to telling every story through a partisan lens, and partisanship suggests that there's one side believes one thing and the other side believes the other thing. I actually find the bigger problem, bigger than climate skepticism, certainly bigger than climate denial, is climate complacency. So when I see that 73% of Americans are worried about climate change, I think, why aren't those people more concerned? Why is it that the median commitment that the average American is willing to make to fight climate change is $1 a month? Most are not willing to contribute $10 a month to fight it. And because of the changing economic dynamics I talked about earlier, I'm not sure that we'll need to ask those people to even commit that amount of money towards fighting climate change, but it's a sign of how weakly committed to the story we are. So when I look out at the landscape, I see the problem of climate complacency as a much, much bigger one, much more important to solve than the one of skepticism and denial. And I think that giving those people a stronger sense of urgency of just how much is at stake, just how fast it's moving, just how threatened everything we take for granted about our lives today is by this force, will, I hope, make their commitments to action on climate more intense. And from that, we can start to evolve a more ambitious climate policy, which we're already seeing. And we're seeing that in part because of the climate protest movements, the unprecedented climate protest movements of the last 6 or 9 months, which are happening in the U.S. in the form of the Sunrise Movement, but also in Europe with the climate strikes led by Greta Thunberg, and in the U.K. with Extinction Rebellion. These are really amazing signs of progress, which I would not have honestly believed if you had told me that they were coming a year or so ago. I, like many other people, thought that our climate politics were totally inert. But in fact, not only are those people out in the streets marching, they're having a concrete impact on our politics, so that, you know, Greta has persuaded the president of the EU to commit, I think, 1 out of every 3 euros to mitigating the climate change. Extinction Rebellion in the UK has forced the British Parliament to declare a climate emergency and put together a plan for how to get to zero carbon emissions by 2050, which isn't quite ambitious enough for me, but is a remarkable statement of ambition given where they were just a few years ago. And in the US, we have the Green New Deal, which is, you know, it's a preliminary document, and we still have to fill out the details. Exactly what it means for policy is not yet clear, but as a statement of ambition, is so much bigger and grander and more serious than anything that Democrats had put forward before, that I think it's hard not to be exhilarated by it as someone who cares about climate change. And honestly, just as remarkable that all the major presidential, Democratic presidential candidates have endorsed that statement of ambition, at least as a statement of ambition, at least as a rhetorical commitment, which puts the needs of science first rather than defining our climate policy through what we think of as politically feasible. I think that reversal is quite dramatic, quite exciting. And, you know, I wouldn't have said that it was even possible a year ago. That's how dramatic the movement has been.
David Wallace Wells, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with us today and for sharing your wonderful insights.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was David Wallace Wells, author of the best-selling book, The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming, which is available from your favorite online bookseller. He joined us today by Skype. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.